Welcome to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm Mark Moss, your host. Tell Us Something seeks to celebrate the craft of live storytelling. The Missoula community comes together for a night of shared stories, told live, focused on a theme. Tell Us Something is a quarterly event. Everyone has a story. What's yours? This quarter's Tell Us Something was recorded on December 3rd, 2013, at the Top Hat in Missoula, Montana. This edition of Tell Us Something features 8 storytellers telling a story based upon the theme, Promises. This week's story comes to us from Amy Rosendahl and is titled, Accidents Happen. Thank you for listening.
All right. Thank you for everyone being here tonight. My story starts in August of 2010, when my boyfriend of 2 years was doing something called speed flying, which is flying small skydiving canopies off of mountains. So it sounds crazy, but he was working towards a goal called base jumping, which if you've seen kind of the crazy squirrel flying people in YouTube videos jumping off of mountains in their wingsuits and flying and then opening their parachutes and safely landing on the ground, or if their parachute doesn't open, then they're dead. So speed flying, though, however, was his kind of segue from skydiving into base jumping. And so speed flying is using a small skydiving parachute and starting at the top of the mountain. In his case, he would go up to Mount Jumbo where all the paragliders would go. And he would get the parachute laid out behind him and then take a sprint start and get the parachute up over his head and then fly as fast as he could down to the landing spot. So there's no gaining in altitude. There's just flying very fast down. And in August 13th of 2010, he was taking his fourth flight of the day, and it didn't go so great. He was trying to do a trick that maybe he shouldn't have been trying, but he was trying to push himself to the limit and trying to progress fast so that he could get to his bigger goal of base jumping. And on his fourth flight of the day, he tried that trick, and he tangled his parachute up, and he fell between 200 and 300 feet onto his back onto Mount Jumbo. He should not be alive today, but he is. And after that crash, he got very lucky. There was someone on the mountain there to save him and call for a light flight and to keep him stable. And when he got to the ER, within a half an hour of the call into emergency, which is amazing that he was able to get there in a half an hour by the life flight helicopter, they had stated that his condition is grave, and I had never heard that before. I always thought it was critical or serious or whatever, but his condition was grave. And I found out at 3:30 in the morning when they had called me, and they had found his phone. He was flying alone that day, so they had no idea who he was. And they called me at 3:30 in the morning, and I jumped out of bed because I knew it was a lady on the phone calling from his cell phone. And she was calling from St. Pat's, and I knew that if he wasn't the one on the phone, that something was seriously wrong. And so I went to the hospital, and they pulled me aside into a separate room. And I was like, oh, shit, a separate room. This can't be good. And, you know, she told me that things weren't looking good and that Joe was not, you know, possibly not going to make it. And I was out of my mind. I didn't even know what that meant. What does that mean? What was wrong with him? And what happened? And how did he fall? And what was going on? And I'll never forget that first time that I walked into his room in the ICU, and there were so many cords and lines and things attached to him. It was unbelievable. I hope you never have to see your loved one like that. And I just remember going over and trying to find a place to put my hand, and I just said, oh, Joe. And then I had to walk out because I thought I was going to pass out. And for the next month, they had put him into a drug-induced coma because his body was so damaged that it was not responding well to anything, and he was on a ventilator, and he was in traction, and you know, ultimately the doctors were telling us he had broken 8 vertebrae in his neck and back. He had a laceration to his liver. His lungs were so badly bruised that he wasn't getting enough oxygen that they were worried about brain damage and what that would mean. And so for a month, every single day that went by was touch and go. We thought, oh man, every day the doctors would come to us with something new. With this counts are too low or these counts are too high and something else is wrong and his stomach shouldn't look like that and his bowel movements shouldn't look like that, and everything was just horrible, and every day was horrible, and every day was a chance that he could possibly die. And actually, a couple times his heart did stop, and they had to code him, and those were the worst times by far. But he had his neck surgery, and they did say he had spinal cord damage at the C7 level, so that's in your neck. So we were told that he was going to be a quadriplegic, and what that meant we didn't know at the time. We didn't know what kind of function he was going to have or what kind of life he was going to live after that. But when they finally were able to pull him out of that coma, his parents immediately had him on a life jet back to Minnesota. But right before that life jet left, I remember having a moment with him in the room, and I said, "Joe, I will come back to Minnesota. I will be there for you, and we will get through this together. We will do this together. It will be okay. Do you want me to do that? Is that okay with you?" And he said, "Absolutely." And I said, "I promise we will get through this together, and we will do this. It'll be okay. Just be strong. Know everything that's going on and pay attention to what they're doing to you so that you can know what's going on with your body." And within minutes, it seemed like they had him wrapped up and into the life jet, and then he was gone. And I had to just wrap up things in Missoula. I said, "I'll be there in 3 weeks." And I couldn't wait that long. 2 weeks later, I had given almost everything away that I had owned or sold it, tried to find a subleaser, finish out my job, and get in the car with a friend and get back to Minnesota to be by his side. And I got back to Minnesota, and 4 months later, he was released from the hospital, and in that 4 months, he was in ICU, in acute care to get off the ventilator, and then into rehab, into PT and OT and everything that meant. And I don't even think I knew what that meant at the time. I don't think I knew what that promise meant, was that we were going to get through that together. But that meant a lot of really hard days and really long days. And in the hospital, it was learning how to take care of and learning how to do all the things that he couldn't do for himself. And a lot of that was simple things that we all take for granted every single day. How do you go to the bathroom? How do you take a dump when you have a spinal cord injury? You need help with that. You need a catheter when you have a spinal cord injury. And Joe was too weak to do that for himself. So I was the one that was to do that for him because I made that promise. And in the hospital, it was quite easy. We had nurses and nurses' aides and everybody that could help with that. And we were so excited to get out of the hospital. Oh my gosh, it'll be so great. We'll have so much time to relax and get up and get ready for the day. And we won't be on the schedule of PT and OT. And we'll just be able to go home and it'll just be us and it'll be okay. And I didn't know that having that help of nurses and nurses' aides and doctors, how much that meant. Because when we got home, it was really hard. And I had to work a full-time job in addition to taking care of him full-time. And taking care of him full-time was doing everything that we all take for granted. And it is going to the bathroom and showering and getting from the bed into the wheelchair, from the wheelchair into the shower, helping give him a shower, giving him a shower into the wheelchair, from the wheelchair to the bed, from the bed to the wheelchair, from the wheelchair to the couch, into the car. He wasn't driving. Couldn't drive yet again. So taking him to every appointment. But then I had to work, too, because somebody has to pay the bills, right? So in doing that, Joe made a promise to me, and he said, I will be independent within 1 year because I want to do that for you. And within 7 months of Joe's accident, he became independent, and that is just the basic things. That is being able to get yourself dressed and go to the bathroom and not even driving yet, just being able to get yourself up and feed yourself and do those basic things. And he kept that promise to me. And now 3 years later, after his accident, he has gone above and beyond. And he has set goals that I can't even imagine setting as an able-bodied person. But Joe Stone set a goal last year to be the first quadriplegic to complete an Ironman triathlon. And last month, at the beginning of November, we drove down to Florida together with all of his gear in a trailer. And he attempted Ironman Florida. And for all of you that don't know what that is a 2.4-mile swim in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a 112-mile bike ride. And it's a full marathon, 26.2 miles. And Joe worked his ass off all summer long to be able to get to that start line. And when he was at that start line, I think we both kind of had a little moment of what we've been through in the last 3 years and how far we've come and how far those promises have taken us. And Joe didn't finish the Ironman that day. He finished the swim. And if any of you could have seen the waters on that day, there was a storm that came in the day before the Ironman, and the waters were pretty tumultuous. So the fact that he even did the swim was unbelievable to me and to many people around us. But he finished the swim, and he was 2 minutes shy of the cutoff time because they have cutoff times in Ironman. So if you don't finish the swim in a certain amount of time, you're done. And if you don't finish the bike in a certain amount of time, you're done. But he didn't finish the swim. He was 2 minutes shy. And that was devastating to us. But the beautiful thing about Joe and about our promise to each other is that he will try again, and he will get up and do it again. Because that is the promise that he made to live his life after his life was almost taken. And our promise to each other to just make every day count. So that's our story. Thank you.
Thank you for your support of live storytelling and local art. Thanks to the bookstore at the University of Montana, a local bookstore serving the students, faculty, and staff of the University of Montana, as well as the Missoula community. MontanaBookstore.com. Fact and Fiction, where books, authors, ideas, and readers interact. FactandFictionBooks.com. Top Hat Lounge, bringing great music to Missoula for over 60 years, the Top Hat now serves food and offers, in addition to great music, comedy shows, film, and performance art. TopHatLounge.com. Jonathan Marquis. Jonathan Marquis is an artist and human in Missoula, Montana. Learn more about him and his art at SubjectToGravity.com. That's Subject2Gravity.com. Matt LaRubio, screen printing and graphic design. Learn more about Matt and what he has to offer at ranchhanddesign.com. Rockin' Rudy's, your source for the best music, gifts, and more. Great music, great people, rockinrudy's.com. And thank you to everyone who attends the events, those of you who download the podcasts, and to the storytellers, Gregory T. Johnson, Susie Risho, Samuel Jackson Enemy Hunter, Stephanie Wing, Taz Chellen, John Engen, Amy Rosendahl, Andrea Davis, and Michael Marsalek. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. The next Tell Us Something is scheduled for February 11th at the Top Hat. The theme is, What Are You Waiting For? The official Tell Us Something site is tellussomething.org. Thank you again for your support and your interest in live storytelling and local art here in Musical Mind.